I don't know. Thousands of years ago, it crashes, and this thing gets thrown out or crawls out, and it ends up freezing in the ice.
I just cannot believe any of this voodoo bullshit.
Childs, happens all the time, man. They're falling out of the skies like flies. Government knows all about it, right, Mac?
You believe any of this voodoo bullshit, Blair?
Childs? Chariots of the gods, man. They practically own South America. I mean, they taught the Incas everything they know.
Hey, Adrenaline Heads. Welcome back. I'm Mark.
And I'm Jerry.
And this week we are covering the 1982 movie The Thing by John Carpenter. So the reason why I got Jerry on here, because both of us love this film, and we have a lot of fond memories of this film. It's definitely a cult classic, and it's something that I'm pretty sure a lot of you have seen. So if you have not seen it, go back and watch it, because I'm sure there are people out there who haven't. Watch it and come back to the podcast, or if you're interested in being spoiled all over the place, then do so. Listen to us and send any feedback if you like regarding that, what your experience was. That would be awesome. So to begin, the synopsis for The Thing by John Carpenter in 1982 is, in a remote Antarctica, a group of American research scientists are disturbed at their base camp by a helicopter shooting at a sled dog. When they take in the dog, it brutally attacks both human beings and canines in the camp, and they discover that the beast can assume the shape of its victims. Resourceful helicopter pilot, played by Kurt Russell, and the camp doctor, by Richard Dysart, lead the camp crew in a desperate, gory battle against a vicious creature before it picks them all off one by one. Now, there's a lot more into this movie that is said in that synopsis, because within our state of affairs now, with everybody being fearful of everybody else and everything else that's going on, this movie represents that. And I think you feel the same way, Jerry.
Oh, yes, I do. And it's just about, you know, the trust between the men is kind of compromised because of what's happening.
Exactly. It's a really thrilling ride, this movie, when it gives you the chills, gives you that fear, just as they did. And well, we're gonna break it down to the things that we love within the movie itself. So with that, in this movie, it's a cast of an amazing set of actors, and I'll start off. Kurt Russell, obviously we knew him mostly in the 70s as a Disney kid, but he got his first real adult start as playing Elvis in a John Carpenter film. It was John Carpenter's, like, I think it was after Halloween at that point. So we see him in that. Then that led him to working with Carpenter again into a more adult-oriented role in Escape from New York. So he played Snake Plissken. And then we get this, which shows how Russell is really good at playing these cool characters that we know. So, you know, it shows what a badass he could be. And I've heard stories of Kurt Russell saying that he's a real badass in real life too. So
yeah, and he seems like it too. And then he comes off that way in this film. And I'd say the beard is very, you know, is part of that character as well, I think so.
Yeah, definitely. Then we have Keith David. Well, we've seen him in such movies as They Live.
Mm-hmm. Which I isn't love that one.
Yeah,
one
same
favorites.
Here. Yeah, yeah. It's part of, like, you know, I have a top 10 of my Carpenter films that I love, and They Live is in that. We also see him in Men at Work with Charlie Sheen and Emilio Estevez. More comedic take, but typical of how Keith David plays his characters, if you think about it. And of course, the current TV shows that are out there, of one show that he's in, is Blackish. So you get to see him as an older gentleman who plays pretty much almost the same character. Next up,
We have Richard Dysart, mm-hmm. who did other TV roles such as L.A. Law. Mm-hmm. And we also have, he was in Pale Rider and Being There. And I think if I remember right, he was in Spawn, if I remember right.
Yes.
some of the Todd McFarlane stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a Todd McFarlane film from Todd McFarlane's comic book, too.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. And we got Wilford Brimley. We all know him. He was in Cocoon, The China Syndrome. And at one point, he was the Country Time Lemonade Man at one point. He did all the commercials and stuff on that, which is pretty funny, too. When I went to trade school for audio engineering, I met the guy before him who did the voice that everybody knew on the radio and on commercials before Mr. Brimley took over. He also did the Quaker Oats commercials. And, of course, we all know him as that diabetes guy.
Yeah. And one of the roles that really kind of, like, solidified these, like one of the things that made me say I'll never look at Quaker Oats the same way again is when he was in the firm as the firm's security guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was – that was, like – holy crap. And that was like, I had first knew him as the Quaker Oats guy, you know, after seeing, and I kind of didn't put the two together after, you know, seeing him in the thing, but it's like later, it's like, holy crap, it is him.
So, yep. Next up, we have Richard Mazur, and we've seen him in Risky Business with Tom Cruise, License to Drive with, the both Coreys, Corey Feldman and Corey Haim. Yep. Mm-hmm. And so much more, he usually winds up playing like a dad role, but in this one, he played El Capitan with the pistol, you know?
Oh, no, I think that was Donald Moffat.
Oh, I think you're right. Yeah, sorry.
He was the kennel keeper.
Yes, but Mazur always did play a father figure. Yeah, you're right. I forgot. He's got the big beard, everybody. I got them twisted.
Yes, and he also was in the original It miniseries as well, but not for a whole much of it, so.
No, he wasn't. I think he was one of the main characters, but as an adult, yeah.
Yeah.
And like you said, Donald Moffat, you know, he was in The Right Stuff, Clear and Present Danger, and Popeye, the movie with Robin Williams.
I don't remember him in Popeye.
I do. Yeah, he was one of the side roles. Like, I don't know if he was the mayor, but he was an important figure in there, and you could see him in that. And next up, T.K. Carter, who we know from Corvette Summer. Mm-hmm. The cool guy in Dr. Detroit with with all those ladies of the night. And so much more that was pretty much comedy. You know, that was mostly his focus in acting, was mostly comedy. You'll remember him. And if you don't know who he is, he's the guy who's got the roller skates. Maybe we're at war with Norway.
And then we have Thomas Waits as Windows.
Yes, Tom Waits.
And he was in, let's see, another one called Shakedown and Money Train later on. And I don't remember him in a whole lot of other things because, this is like his most memorable role for me.
Yeah, same here. That's the only one that I could remember him from. And last up would be Charles Hallahan, and we know his face. He's always had red hair. And he was in Dante's Peak, which also we covered on Run For Your Lives when we covered that, when Daphne and Paik allowed me to be on their podcast and have fun with that one. I remember him. And then Pale Rider as well. He was in that movie as well. And Twilight Zone, the movie.
Yeah, and I remember him from the Hunter TV show as well. So he was one of their captains, I think so.
Yep. And he pretty much had a long career in TV as well. So I think it was Hunter, Quantum Leap, and a whole bunch of other films, TV shows. Yeah. So with that, you know, like we said, we have a full cast of amazing actors in this film, and they definitely bring it to the table when it comes to this particular type of movie with their individual quirks and characters. So we'll move on to general thoughts of the movie. And Jerry, give us your idea. What's your general thoughts overall?
So overall, this movie is very tense and very terrifying once it gets going, because when it establishes what's going on, you know, after they take in the dog and what happens when you see the dog roaming around the camp, and then you see what happens later with the dog kind of revealing itself in the kennel. After that happens is that the movie takes this terrifying overall tone of I call it just paranoia for the entire run for the rest of the film.
Yeah, definitely. I would agree with that, that description of it. Well, originally you know, I'm a huge John Carpenter fan, like I stated. I love this movie since I saw it when I was, I think it was 13 at the time. And it's definitely in my top five of Carpenter films.
Yeah. So. And this is like one of my top horror films ever. So because I remember when I first saw it, it's like after this, the dog thing happened in the kennel, I am like sitting there just with a chill down my back for the entire rest of the movie. Because you don't know who's who.
Yeah. I love the original film that this was created from as well. Mm-hmm. And that was The Thing in 1951, but The Thing from Another World. And in that particular movie had James Arness. It was a black and white film. And you don't really see anything of the creature in that movie until the very end when they electrocute it. Now, that might be a spoiler for any of you out there, but honestly, that movie's been around for how many years?
Almost 60. No, 70, excuse me.
70 years old, yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing that after seeing this, after seeing The Thing from 82. Remember mm-hmm. seeing that one, and I've always liked those 1950s movies as well.
Yeah, I'm a huge old horror fan when it comes to the Universal monsters. Mm-hmm. I like that kind of aspect, especially the man in his suit. Now, obviously, in this movie, there's no man in suit. There's a lot of puppetry and stuff going on.
Exactly, yeah.
Amazing. And trust me, listeners, if you're not watch the movie, go see it. The thing that we're going to probably concentrate most on is a lot of the effects, how they did that and things of that nature. If you're really interested in it and you have seen it, get the special edition Blu-rays that are out there because they come with a commentary with John Carpenter. They come... another commentary with John Carpenter as well as Kurt Russell and Carpenter's take on the music within it, which he does. So I recommend that highly. And both the 51 movie and this one were based originally on the novel Who Goes There. And it's a novella that formed the basis of The Thing. And it was done by John W. Campbell. And the brief description they give about it is about an Antarctic research camp that discovers and thaws the ancient frozen body of a crash-landed alien. And that's it. So they kind of have a lot of play when it comes to what they're doing within the movies. So they kind of changed it for their own perspective. John Carpenter gave us an extreme one, whereas the original 51, they worked with what they have, and they gave us, it was more of the suspense of everything. Because like I said, you don't see the creature until the end. Whereas with this one, you kick off pretty much after the first 20 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
And you're just anticipating these jumps and these things that happen. And then you get the fear and the trust issues within the characters themselves. And then it's like, who is it at that point, you know? So...
and one of my other things is that the thing we're fighting here is actually kind of like a molecular, it's like in its cellular form.
Yeah.
And you can't really fight something that doesn't take an alien shape of like one singular organism. It can be anything it ever touched.
Which we do see at the very end of the film, because you see some creature on the very top. You see the dogs come out in the middle and you see people's faces. Mm-hmm. It was an amalgam of everything that it touched in the universe, I guess. So,
yeah,
and with that, we're going to move on to our favorite scenes, which kind of leads into some of that stuff. So what is your first one?
My first one is the character of Bennings. When he gets left alone by Windows in a storage room where the thing's body is under a blanket.
Yeah.
And Windows, I forget what he does. He has to go do something. And when he comes back, he sees Bennings wrapped up in tentacles and all bloody. So.
Yep. And actually, when Windows starts to walk away, they pan over to the table and you see the blanket or the tarp move where the body was, where something slipped down off and poured down. So that was kind of like an initial thought of like, oh, darn, what's going to happen? And that was very intense, too, the way they did that as far as how they created that effect. And a lot of they do a lot of stuff with reverse photography where they pull things out of you. And I think they were working through with that when they did that shot.
Yeah. And when with that, with Bennings, so when they everybody catches up to him. And he's kneeling in the snow and he has these like gigantic alien hands.
Yeah.
and they're about, you know, something like the size of tennis rackets.
Yep.
And that this ungodly scream that he puts out, that's, I've always, that,
that, you know, howl.
That howl is chilling to a 12-year-old kid when I first saw it.
Oh, yeah. And they pour gas on it and they torch it and get it on fire. Yep. Well, my first one up. Well, the eeriness of the movie overall, I thought was amazing. The music is really awesome. I just love Carpenter and his work in his films because he chooses to do his own music. And that that stems all the way back to Halloween. And he uses synths. And it's just that ominous tone that he uses within this. It's like all you hear is like that boom, boom, boom from that bass line.
Yeah, I call it the heartbeat.
Yeah, that's literally what it sounds like at a point, but a very, very low resolution.
Yes.
So I have not counted how many Carpenter soundtracks I have, but I have a lot that are on CD from Varese Araband. And, you know, every time I feel like I'm in the mood, I'll play it. Actually, I went to a con and somebody was playing the Prince of Darkness soundtrack, and I called out the moderator of the panel. Dave Solo, and I say, hey dude, I love that soundtrack. He goes, oh, so do I. And he goes, Carpenter's great, right? We just had a good conversation about it. But, you know, it was just my favorite scene that leads up to that, and the whole very beginning is when you see the Norwegian helicopter coming in and shooting at the dog, and he's literally shooting at in the camp at that point, and that's when he gets taken out. That's what starts the little bit of the terror that we get. It's not as ominous because they're going after a dog, but it sets up what we're about to get into. And actually, I don't know if you're a fan of it, but I liked the second version where it was a prequel that came out not too long ago with Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Like that one too. Yeah.
I like that one as well. So I love how they kind of merged that. So you could actually watch that particular movie first and then go into this. So that movie came out, I would say, a good 4 or 5
2011,
years.
I want to say.
Wow, that far. Hey, yeah. So it's about 9 years ago. But regardless, it adds up. So if you're going to do a back-to-back thing watch, I would suggest doing that first and then watch this one. You might appreciate this one more than you would that one, because the effects in that one are more modern at times. They did use some practical effects, but you could see some of the CG work in it. That's the only thing that I could say negative about it. I like the story. I like the aspect of it, but this one holds true, and I like this one far, far more. But I'll always go back to that one just to do like a marathon, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, and that one, that one had its own, because, I'm okay with the CGI. And I think it was because with what they wanted to portray was kind of necessary for CGI to have that.
Yeah, they would had to use stop motion for certain parts of it with the one split thing that got frozen that we see at the end, which they wind up taking with them in the helicopter. Because that's where it leads up.
Merged spaces.
Yes, exactly. And we see how that comes to be.
Yes, that creeped me out.
Yeah. So you had another one here that you liked?
Yes, there is one where the character of Norris has a heart attack.
Yes.
And they put him on the table in the infirmary, and Dr. Copper does the defibrillators.
Yes.
On the second try, his hands go through, and in the abdomen breaks open, it becomes a mouth and bites his forearms off.
Yep.
And I'm like, what? And so that one is just, it was an audible scream in the room when we're all watching this. And it's like, that freaked me the hell out.
Yeah, I think that's the first thing that freaks everybody out when they see this movie. Especially when, going into the effects of it, they used an actual amputee when they did that.
Yeah.
So when it happened, they had fake arms. And then when it came, it just bit off. And that was it. looked almost like a bear trap at a point.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, my goodness.
That's not a movie you want to take on a first date, by the way.
Yeah. So. Unless you're both horror fans, but.
Yeah, exactly. Next one up would be the blood test scene. They call it the blood serum test.
Yes.
And I love that scene because of how intense it was. And then, when you have him there and he's burning the piece of metal with the torch, and he's got the cups of blood. Now, mind you, there was a fake hand holding one, and then it just pops out. And that was like a complete jump scare, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And the one scene that you were talking about when, you know, Norris is on the table and that happens,
his head pops off,
but turns into a, like a crab.
See, and it's upside down, and then the eye stalks come out, and it's like what in the bloody heck is this?
It's so ingenious, though. I just love that. Mm-hmm. The amount of work that goes into that kind of puppetry and to make that thing happen.
Yes.
And the next one would be Wilfred Brimley's character going off and destroying everything and shooting at everyone. Yeah. That point when you think he's going insane, and mm-hmm. he screams that it didn't want to be a dog. It wanted to be us, as he axes all the computers. He knew something because he did the data test of what, you know, with the computer to seeing how long it would take over the whole world from point of first contact. Now, that's kind of ingenious to have in a 1982 film.
Yes.
Yeah, that's something you would see later on in the 90s or even 2000s, early 2000s at that point. But in this, they went a little bit more and their creative thought process, you know, mind you, it's 1982 technology with the computers. That's the only thing that really seems to date it, along with the VHS, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie can be done modern day if they wanted to, because all it is being isolated.
Yeah. And that's like one of the things that makes it kind of terrifying, too, is that you're trapped, you know. Yes. And how far are you away from any civilization and any help?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just love how that, you know, they finally knock him out. MacReady gets a good punch on him.
Yes.
You know, he gets that good punch on him, and they kind of lock him away in a separate station house or something. Mm-hmm. And when they come back to visit him, MacReady goes back, and you see the noose hanging in the back, and him pleading, saying, "I'm all right, I'm all right."
Yeah, okay. With the noose in front of you.
I'm like, okay, that would be. Hold on, there's a red flag going on here, sir.
You know, a red flag is literally hanging in front of him. So.
Yeah, well, the thing is you know that he is infected by that point, and apparently he was up to some other dastardly things down in that place as well. So we'll get to that later, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Next up would be Chiles and MacReady at the end waiting it out in the cold.
Yeah,
it's just the last thing we fade to. That it just leaves it so ominous. It can lead to another sequel if need be, but I don't think they would ever go back to it. I don't think Carpenter would ever go back to it.
Yeah, I never saw the need to go back to that, because I like that it was left open-ended.
Yeah, it could be anything. Or they could just
have. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You know, I've read some speculation as to when they're passing the bottle back and forth, is that, you know, you see breath from MacReady and you don't see breath from Child, but I think it just had to do with the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just one of those things. He says, you know, if either one of us is, we're not really a position to do anything about it.
That is true.
And if one of them was the thing, it's like it kind of accomplished its goal. It's like it just wants to freeze and let the rescue team find it.
Yeah.
So you don't know what happened.
Yeah. The one thing about this film that we both agree upon is that this thing holds up. This movie holds up after how many years? This is 82.
Almost 40 years. Yeah.
Almost 40 years. 38 years.
Yes.
That this movie is now, it's 2020, we're going on 2021, so literally it's 39 years, but the fact is it still holds up. You could watch it anytime, and like I stated, if they wanted to create a new version of this, they can. All they have to eliminate out is like the VHS stuff,
mm-hmm.
the types of computers they are using, as well as the electronic chess set that that MacReady uses, or they could just leave that in because it's just been sitting in that station for so long.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I've always called that the ultimate MacReady rage quit when it checkmates him and he pours his drink into it.
Yeah. I was like, that was a waste of a good scotch right there. All right. So we're going to be moving on to interesting facts and unknown facts about the movie, The Thing, from 1982. So I'll first start off with Well, it was a flop with the audiences, and it was partly E.T.'s fault.
Yes.
So where the thing lacks in comedy, it makes up for tenfold in claustrophobia, paranoia, loneliness, and some of the most incredibly frightening practical effects in film history. Yet audiences were none too receptive to the film, at least at first, as The Thing earned just shy of $20 million at the domestic box office. That was in 82, so it did make money, but went on to becoming a cult classic.
Yes.
So the movie tanked when it came out. Carpenter admitted in a post-screening Q&A at the Cape Town Film Festival in 2013, it was hated by fans. I lost a job. People hated me. They thought I was horrible, violent, and I was. But now here we are, and he says, this is 31 years later, and here you are filling the theater. So basically, it built a big reputation. So what it didn't do in the very beginning, it worked out for him in the end.
Yeah.
And part of the problem was that The Thing opened 2 weeks after E.T., and while E.T. featured a benevolent alien and happy ending, The Thing starred a violent, evil alien had an ending that left audiences scratching their heads a bit. And Carpenter goes on saying, I'd made really grueling dark, made a really grueling dark film, and I just don't think audiences in 1982 wanted to see that. They wanted to see E.T., and The Thing was just the opposite.
Yeah,
oh, which is basically it. You know, well, you had a movie of an alien for kids, and then you had a movie for an alien for an adults.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, and the critics didn't take too kindly to it either. Yeah. It's like critics on the film looked on it as just as unfavorably as the fans when it was released in 82.
Mm-hmm.
One critic wrote, The Thing is a foolish, depressing, overproduced movie that mixes horror with science fiction to make something that is fun as neither one thing or the other. Sometimes it looks as aspired to be the quintessential moron movie of the 80s, a virtually storyless feature combined of lots of laboratory concocted special effects with the actors being used merely as props to be hacked / disemboweled and decapitated, and finally to be eaten and then regurgitated as, guess what? More laboratory concocted special effects.
Yeah, Roger Ebert apparently was only slightly kinder with his 2.5-star review in the Chicago Sun-Times. And he wrote, The Thing is a great barf bag movie, all right. Is it any good? I found it disappointing for two reasons. The superficial characterizations and the implausible behavior of the scientists on that icy outpost. Characters have never been Carpenter's strong point. He says he likes his movies to create emotions in his audiences. And I guess he'd rather see us jump 6 inches and then get involved in the personalities of these characters, which is very much the opposite of how I felt. Because it actually made me more interested in the characters and how they were going to react when I was watching it.
I feel that way, too. So.
Yeah, The Thing is basically then just a geek show, gross-out movie in which teenagers can dare one another to watch the screen. There's nothing wrong with that. I like being scared, and I was scared by many scenes in The Thing. But it seems clear that Carpenter made his choice early on to concentrate on special effects and technology and to allow the story and people to become secondary. Not necessarily. It added to it, in my opinion.
Yes.
You know, it was just icing on the cake with all the cool effects, in my opinion. But that's what my go-to is. And better, especially in the original The Thing and in Alien, there's no need to see the version, this version's, unless you are interested in that thing might look like while starting from anonymous greasy organs, excreting giant crab legs, and transmuting itself into a dog. Amazingly, I'll bet that thousands, if not millions, of moviegoers are interested in seeing just that. Well, he was right, and it became a classic.
and like we said before, it's not a remake, because we had the 1951 Thing from Another World. Mm-hmm. And they do share the same source material, as you said.
Yeah. You don't have to read that. It's fine.
Yeah.
So basically, I would check out the book if you're out there, listeners. And if you're really interested and you have never seen The Thing from Another World from 1951, I would suggest it if you are interested in classic horror films, you know. But in the end, you know, Carpenter does, however, play homage to the earlier film, most notably in the scene where he shows the alien's icy tomb that has been removed from the snow and in the main title sequence.
Yes.
So,
you know, where they have that, I almost want to call it the burned out trash bag effect.
Well, but, there's that big scene when they go see the ship where the Norwegians had dug it out. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go to Universal's backlot tour, might not be able to go to them now in this day and age with COVID and all that that's going on. I went to Universal Studios California twice in my lifetime. I always loved that tour. Now, they changed it since 90 when I first went, and then again when I went later on in early 2000s, I believe. And basically, there's a the largest backdrop in the world over a man-made lake that they did. And that's where they filmed that whole scene. So they had to create fake snow and everything within front of that backdrop. And now you're talking, this is California, and I believe they filmed, I could be wrong, so somebody out there could correct me if they want. It was summer when they did that, and they were sweating inside their suits and everything because they had to make it like it was cold. So they had to do something to get the breath out of there, and then they had to wear all that gear to make it look like it was freezing out. So that's a cool tidbit from that particular scene. So if you could actually go out there, they talk about that on a Universal tour when you go on.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been on that tour, but I've been there. I've been a couple times as well.
Yeah, so. We already mentioned it. A double amputee was used to create the film's quintessential special effect that Jerry loves.
And then we have Stan Winston, who is a makeups effect icon, worked on this film, albeit uncredited.
Yes.
And we have Rob Bottin, I think it's pronounced.
Yes.
And who had to be, because of the stress of this job, had to be hospitalized for exhaustion.
Yes.
And given what I know about what I've read about the certain effects that were done and destroyed due to, you know, the flammability of the material that was they were made from, you know, it took them, I think it took them a couple of months to make the Norris thing that burned up, you know, that burned up, and some of the stuff had to be redone. And I think they had to redo it, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Yeah. And he's known for other movies like Alien, Predator, Jurassic Park, and you know, and he didn't want to accept credit. Winston didn't want to accept credit for Bottin's work because he considered it his Rob's film.
Yeah, and actually, I believe Rob was supposed to be on American Werewolf in London originally when this was done, and he got pulled off of that to do this particular film, and he was never the special effects guy. He worked for a crew, so he was brought off from a crew that he was just a part of at that time to be on this as a lead special effects artist, just supervised by Stan Winston apparently in the background.
Yeah,
which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and he was what, 24 I think it was when he was doing this as a lead.
Yes. And he had to get very creative with those jello arms. And they were using bubble gum and anything that in all these rubber veins and everything that like you stated, if you look at them, it was toxic. They actually talk about it in when they narrate the movie Carpenter and Russell and how bad it was, the smell and the stench. And they had to walk out the set every once in a while to air it out.
Yes. And then we also have something I didn't know is that, you know, in some of these effects where they used, where they had all the explosions, it says Kurt Russell almost did himself in with a stick of dynamite.
Yeah, you actually do see it on camera. It was that one shot where he throws the dynamite.
Yeah.
I was at the burning scene for Norris, and he just throws it, and you see it, and he just holds back. You know, God forbid if anything hit him.
Yes.
Well, apparently, legendary composer Ennio Morricone penned the score. John Carpenter famously writes the music for most of his movies. However, being that The Thing was his first studio film, and because he was short on time, he asked Ennio to do the honors. Morricone, a 5-time Oscar nominee known for his work with Sergio Leone, obliged and crafted a synthesizer-laden score very reminiscent of Carpenter's own composing style.
Yes.
But Carpenter actually played synth on this. He did not compose the work, but he was playing on it when it was recorded. So yeah. I was a bit wrong on that, but I just remembered him playing it.
Yeah, and that's one thing about, you know, that the way Morricone put it together is that that heartbeat music that adds to that tension.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very, very similar to how Carpenter actually does his own music. Mm-hmm. He uses beats and measures of different syncopations within keyboards to get that kind of effect and feeling within a scene. And I really enjoy that. That comes from, you know, when I worked in recording studios dealing with a lot of keyboard players. So the U.S. camp and the Norwegian camp are one and the same. So they were the same sets at that point. John Carpenter comes from the school of low budget filmmaking and as such knows how to stretch a dollar. It's the best way to do it. Instead of building an entirely new set from the Norwegian base camp scenes that appear early on in the film, Carpenter just simply filmed those scenes in the charred remnants of the Outpost 31 after it was blown up for the movie's climactic finale. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, because how are you going to know the difference?
No, it's all burning.
Yeah.
So it features an all-male cast. The only females in the movie are the women appearing on a taped version of Let's Make a Deal. Adrian Barbeau's uncredited voice as MacReady's computer. I did not know that. I wish I'd asked her when I met her. And a blow-up doll that never made it into the final cut. That's cool.
I did not know that was Adrian Barbeau's voice.
Me neither. Wow, that's pretty cool. But then again, he did something like this too. Jamie Lee Curtis does the voice of the announcer in Escape from New York in the very beginning when they take him to the prison by Statue of Liberty,
mm-hmm,
before he's sent into New York City. And a lot of people don't know that's her voice. John Carpenter called her in specifically. I guess John called up Adrian Barbeau to come in to do this because he was married to her once.
Mm-hmm.
So, but to move on, Rob Bottin was sensitive about his creatures. So Rob was always very sensitive about all his creatures that he created, recalled cinematographer Dean Cundey. Whether there was too much light on them, we always sort of joked it was up to Rob. He would build the creatures to be incredibly interesting and imaginative and then not put any light on them because he was afraid of showing them. Which is so weird because that one when I think it was Dysart was cutting it, or maybe it was Brimley. They were cutting
it. Yeah.
He cut it away and he's got the gloves on and he's pulling apart the skin and then pulling out more dog.
Yes.
And you don't know what the outer layer is in that one scene. And he's like breaking off things that look like crab's legs.
Yeah.
It too. And it's just so effective. But that was very brightly lit. Mm-hmm. Now, the only one that wasn't as brightly lit was there were two scenes. The one in the dog cage. In the kennel,
yeah,
when it just comes out and then it, you know, the dog splits open, starts coming out and creating itself, and then goes and rises all the way up to the top. And that's when we get where they were burning everything and it was trying to assimilate all the dogs. And then at the very end scene, when they go down into his creepy lair where he was building, of all things, a spaceship out of all the parts of the equipment on base. So yes. That's crafty. I wonder how smart that thing was.
Well, you got to figure how many, you know, what is the sum total of knowledge it's absorbed over its years.
Exactly.
And you got to figure since it arrived in the spaceship, it knew how to fly one. And
know how to create it.
And know how to create one. Because all it had to do is maybe it didn't want to leave the planet. Maybe it just had to get to a populated area.
Exactly. And I think that's really what it was looking to do. So that was pretty cool. But we get to see that ship, but then we get to see the creature in its ultimate form. But it does something really cool. But it, when they're trying to run away from it or run towards something, it's crawling in underground and just spikes up. And then we see that big sort of demon crab looking egg, something. Yeah. I'll just refer to as Biollante from Godzilla versus Biollante, and how it looked like a cross between a lizard mouth with spiked teeth but no eyes.
And I like that it's the one half of it was Blair's head.
Yes.
That was just like, it just turned my stomach, but now when I first saw it turned my stomach, but now it's like I appreciate the creative genius that went into it.
Yeah, you could definitely appreciate the amount of work that went into it. They did a stop motion version of it. I think some of it shows in the final cut.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an extended deleted scene that shows the full stop motion. They did. They had to use some stop motion back then because it was 1982. The only thing that came out that was CG at that time was probably Tron and maybe The Last Starfighter, and that was about it. And they were basic bit-based formed programs.
Yeah.
So with this, they had to go practical and go, you know, Ray Harryhausen at times for certain things.
Yeah, but and
they hold up.
Yeah, and that's that, and that's the one special effects person that came up and with those effects, like the upside down Norris head, you know, for a short bit, and the arms of the final creature, like grabbing the plunger where it would set off the TNT.
Yes.
Yeah, and Harryhausen being another one of my favorites, you know, all the way his effects go, is just, some of them are just absolute masterpieces.
I have two box sets on DVD of Ray Harryhausen, and it has all his collections. They were the two collection set, and you can't really find them on Blu-ray, so I just hold on to them on DVD. They still hold up. I'll put it in. Jason and the Argonauts. There's a couple of others I can't remember, but off the top of my head. But
like some of the Sinbad movies? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the Sinbad, The Eye of the Tiger. Mm-hmm. Being, I think, one of the last few that came out in the 80s.
Yeah, but my favorite of his was Clash of the Titans. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think everybody remembers that one because of the Kraken.
Yeah, and Medusa.
Well, Carpenter feared that audiences might laugh at the film. Interesting. So Carpenter was very nervous about how the audience might react until he saw some of Bateen's effects in person. He goes, "When I started seeing some of the effects that Rob created, it was one particular sequence where Charlie Hallahan's head comes off and the table and the tongue shoots out and pulls itself across and turns over and grows stalks and walks across the floor," which is kind of creepy in the effect of that tongue. When I saw that, I realized a great sense of relief, because what I didn't want to end up with in this movie was a guy in a suit.
Exactly. Which is what the first movie had.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though James Arness is a giant of a man. So.
Yeah, yeah. And it really wasn't that much. It was, mm-hmm. he had lifted boots in that original, you know, Thing movie. They just gave him like a Frankenstein kind of brow. Mm-hmm. They made him green, even though it was in black and white. And they gave him claws and some spiking on his arms. But you really didn't see much of the creature except for when it exploded in and went on the ramp for them to electrocute him.
Yeah.
Carpenter states, "Even as great as Alien was, and Alien was a terrific film, in the very end, up stood this big guy in a suit." So yeah. I guess he was really against the suit actors at that point. And I don't blame him, because he's very different in his idea and his thoughts of what he wants out of a film. Mm-hmm. Now, look at his career now of all the movies he's done with, like, we already spoke about it, They Live, Big Trouble in Little China. And then we had Vampires with James Woods, if you can remember that one, about vampires itself, like in a modern day. There's so many films that you could go over with John Carpenter that I could name off or rattle off. But he's very different in each film. So, and then he also uses a lot of practical effects, because if you remember They Live, that was a low budget film. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Prince of Darkness. There was a 3-picture deal that he was supposed to do before he could get another full big budgeted film. And as I recall, Big Trouble in Little China, Prince of Darkness, and there was one of They Live. He had to do those 3 before he could get more of a multi-million dollar movie that, yeah, he set up for, I forget which film company, but I think it never went through. I'm not sure. I gotta read a book. Read his biography or something.
Mm-hmm.
I already stated this before, a stop motion sequence was filmed but never made it into the actual final cut. So for that pivotal scene near the end of the film where MacReady battles the enormous Blair thing, as they call it, Bateen called upon stop motion expert Randall Cook for help. So Cook created an entire miniature model of the set and filmed the wide angle shot of the monster using stop motion animation. Despite only taking up seconds of screen time, the sequence took countless hours to create, usually stop motion because it's a frame at a time. You take a shot, you move the puppet or the animated animal or creature once in different spots to give specific movies per second, and then you got to take another picture. That takes countless hours. Look at there are documentaries about even, you know, Star Wars movies. If you look at the Wampa and the Tauntauns in Empire Strikes Back, or even the AT-ATs, that's a perfect one too. Yeah. So despite taking only seconds, you know, of screen time, it was scrapped. Ultimately, Carpenter decided not to use the footage as his own. I could detect a stop motion animation. So if you think about it, the end outcome of this particular movie, we get more practical effects than anything. Mm-hmm. Very minimal as when it comes to stop motion photography. But there was an alternate ending that was filmed just in case. So John Carpenter and editor Tom Ramsey shot and cut an alternate ending to the film that was never used. So I would love to see that. Ramsey was concerned that the bleak, ambiguous ending would not test well with audiences. So he suggested to Carpenter to cover his bases and have a spare ending ready to go, which a lot of movies do nowadays, if you think about it. And a lot of people tend to like the alternate version than they do the original at times. So they filmed an additional scene where lead character MacReady, played by Kurt Russell, is rescued and appears in a room where he's given a blood test to determine whether he has been assimilated, which he passes. Fortunately for fans of the film, the alternate ending was not needed as Carpenter stood firmly behind the movie he had made, ambiguous ending and all. So that's something I was not aware of. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that is, you know, I didn't know about that part because I know there's certain films that they will shoot, you know, certain endings and test it with their audiences. And if none of that goes well, they have to go back and do reshoots, which are not highly approved of.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, think about it. What's going on now with Zack Snyder's Justice League? We're getting you're getting the Snyder cut. A whole movie.
Exactly.
All right. So with that, we move on to quotes. So Jerry and I came up with a couple of quotes each. So Jerry, you should go first.
Yeah. The scene where the Norris head is, you know, you see a shot on MacReady and you see the Norris head thing scurrying away behind him. And then you see Palmer and Windows like kind of lean over and Palmer says, "You gotta be fucking kidding." Which is like I laugh at that because it's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, it's what everybody would say or think. What the hell?
And then MacReady torches it. So.
Yeah. Mine would be in the very beginning. And mm-hmm. That would be when they go see the Norwegian base. So it's MacReady and Copper. And MacReady goes, "Hey, Sweden." And Copper's just like, "They're not Swedish, Mac. They're Norwegian."
Yes. Yeah, and my other one, and to this day, it is, you know, I still laugh at this film, and I thank Donald Moffat, God may he rest in peace.
Yeah.
To this day, it still makes me laugh as when after his character Gary passes his hot poker test, he says, "I know you gentlemen have been through a lot, but if you can find the time, I would rather not spend the rest of this winter," and screams, "Tied to this fucking couch."
That's a classic scene, too, coming from him.
Yeah, and I wish I could have met him and said that line was my favorite in damn near any single movie.
Yeah.
Because cool. That just kind of like shows you his frustration, his...
Oh, definitely. He definitely plays it so well.
Yes, and he plays it very well because I felt, you know, and you would feel just as frustrated. It's like, you're not trusted. You're not, you know, not anything.
And you're tied.
And you're tied up. And you have a flamethrower pointed at you, ready to go.
Yeah. Go figure, right?
Exactly.
Well, next one up, or the last one for me, would be the scene where they're all together and MacReady wants to send them all off into twos, so in groups of twos. All of them are very fearful and non-trusting of one another at this point. Mm-hmm. So they're bickering. "I don't want to go with him. I don't want to go with him." So I'm not going to read out everybody because it's pretty much, you get the idea. "Nobody wants to go with that person. I'm not going to go with him." And then MacReady just screams out, and it's something a lot of people sample. "All right, cut the bullshit." and then he goes, and the way he delivers it is, that's the reason why people, you know, they sample it. And actually, I worked in a recording studio with a guitar player, Joe Cefalu, and I think I'm forgetting the name of the album, but I know the song Big Drink is on it, and I actually had to work on it on this, and he goes, bro, gotta check this out. So he had it, and I knew the quote, I knew where it came from. I'm like, that's Kurt Russell. He goes, yeah. So that was at the time in the early 90s when they had Akai samplers, so you had to actually record this thing in some way, and he had to get permission to use it. So I have it somewhere. But MacReady continues on, goes and says to these guys, Windows, you come with us. Norris, you stay here. Any of them move, you fry them. You hear anything? Anything at all. You cut loose on the sirens. We all meet here in 20 minutes regardless. And everybody watch who you're with real close. So it just like pushes more fear and more suspicion. It's like, great, you're more sus than me. Thanks. And you're alone with me, so you can off me. I don't know what happened to him. And actually, that actually does happen in the movie. I had to cut the line.
Yes. Oh, when Knowles leaves MacReady in his shack after finding the...
And that's when he comes in with the flamethrower at that point. So as we come towards the end of this particular podcast, we're going to move into our ratings for this movie. So listeners, you're obviously hearing two people that love this film. They're going to be high praises. Yeah. I don't give tens. And like I said, if I actually go to that whole, you know, Spinal Tap thought of it could go to 11, I will not give it a 10, but I'm not going to go there yet. But with me, I give this movie a 9.7 for me, since it's a Carpenter film and just how intense it is. You just feel it dripping off this movie. And that's just for the intensity of the film, not for it being a horror movie, not for being very bloody or there's some action. It's just more fear and tension than anything.
Yeah, and I give this film a 9.5 for many of the same reasons.
Mm.
Because it's just one of those things, it's just, you watch it and you have, you know, and when you first watch it and not knowing anything about it, you are just made so tense and you just kind of like ball up and you just want, and you feel chills the whole time.
Yeah, but you just can't look away though.
And you can't look away.
So you have to watch the movie. So... now we move on to what I like to call guilty pleasure movies. That could be any movie. Doesn't have to be action. That are not popular or great, but you just love them. But a lot of people have their own opinion. They'd say they hate it. It's got a really bad score on IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes has really, you know, panned it. Or it was just not popular amongst a lot of people. Or people just don't know it because it's really bad and has low budget. And, you know, to me, I love what I love, but, you know, so I just coined it guilty pleasure movies because somebody had mentioned that to me. And I think Ben actually mentioned that recently about on Strange Indeed, about that's a guilty pleasure of his. So that's, it's pretty funny that he brought that up. And I just like, he got that.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what's your guilty pleasure movie?
It's a film from 1989 called Moontrap.
I remember it.
And it stars Walter Koenig and Bruce Campbell and Lee Lombardi. It's about a space shuttle returns to Earth, but some of the equipment, it found an alien spacecraft and brings back some of the equipment, which springs to, springs to life in a mechanical way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it's destroyed on the Earth, but what happens here is that the film begins with the landing of Apollo 11, and with these mechanical things on the moon, see the launch stage from the LEM take off.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
Walter Koenig, wasn't he in Star Trek?
He's in Star Trek, plays Chekhov.
I thought so. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. I haven't seen this movie in so long, though. I remember it. I think I had it and owned it on VHS at one point because mm-hmm. I was collecting all Bruce Campbell movies at one point.
Yeah, and Bruce Campbell is another one of my personal favorites because he knows how to make a freaking funny face.
So. Oh, definitely. I loved him since Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2. Then he mm-hmm. went on to, you know, that ending scene in Darkman.
Yeah.
And then, you know, definitely Hercules and Xena and all that good stuff. And then Army of Darkness, of course, the campiest version of an Evil Dead movie. My guilty pleasure movie, that would be a Lucas classic, but not many people know it. Not people admire it as much, but that would be THX 1138 from 1971.
Wow, it's been years since I've seen that one.
Yeah, I have that on Blu-ray, and I love that movie. I watch it every once in a while just because it's so cold looking the way it's filmed. It looks like, because everything is so metallic and so white and kind of clean, kind of that hospital look to it, you know?
Very, like, antiseptic?
Yeah. Yeah, you could smell the antiseptic in the movie. And that has Robert Duvall and Donald Pleasance in it, too. And that was before Donald Pleasance was, you know, I think known for Halloween, you know, as Loomis. And Duvall at the time was still an actor that was known, but just took the job, I guess. But
wasn't too famous at the time yet.
No, but now we know him.
Well, definitely, yeah. And still around, too, so.
Well, this week we got some feedback from Steve Brown, so I'm going to play that right now.
That was a pretty good shot with that revolver through a broken window at that distance, and it looked like a headshot as well. Hey, Mark and whoever you're with, I think, I can't remember who you're with this week. Just started the John Carpenter's The Thing, and those opening credits, a little different than what we would normally get in the 80s. Only Kurt Russell named as the star and then went right into the music, the composer. And then we get the title card over the shot of the spacecraft. So, all right, I'm going to finish watching it and I'll send some more thoughts. Wow, not just a headshot, through the eye. That hat is wearing Kurt Russell. That's a huge hat. That monologue that Kurt Russell delivers right at, like, it's like 118, 119 about the blood and drawing the blood. Fuck! That is just amazing acting right there. Such a great movie to revisit. And I've watched the ending now a few times because reasons. You're not even sure towards the end whether who really is real and who's not, and just a great tension, and a great movie. John Carpenter, really great director, and alright, nice movie to watch, and can't wait to hear you guys' thoughts on it. Talk to you later.
Well, thanks Steve for sending out your feedback. I love your play on the movie as you're watching it. That was amazing. Thank you again, and we look forward to more of your feedback if you can. It's awesome. Cool. And you could hear both Steve and I on Panels to Pixels on the Next Level Podcast Network. Cheap pop right there. Okay. And now we continue. So if you feel the need, if you want to submit any kind of feedback, well, you could go to our Facebook page, which would be www.facebook.com/AdrenalineCinemaPodcast, or you could just email us, and like what Steve Brown does, he just records his voice and sends it through an email. You could do that, and that could be done through AdrenalineCinemaPodcast@gmail.com. You could send just a regular email if you'd like, and we'll read it out. Or when we do post something on what we're going to be recording that week, because I will do that on occasion, change the wallpaper, put a picture, and then leave your comment below, and we'll just read your comments and your thoughts, and we'll do that there. So with that, you could hear us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, Deezer, or whatever podcast player of choice that you use. If there's a rating there that you could do or a review, that would be really appreciated. You know, I'd like to know what people think. Doesn't hurt. So, Jerry, you're kind of new at this. This would be your first podcast, would it?
Yes, it is my very first podcast.
Cool. So I hope to have you on again, and I hope to hear you on more. I'm sure our friends that are into podcasting will bring you on after they've heard this, too.
Yes, I would like that.
Yeah, cool. So that's pretty much our show, and I just want to thank everybody for listening. I'm Mark.
And I'm Jerry.
And this was Adrenaline Cinema Podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Talk to you later.